You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network. You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the American Hour. My name is Jill Trammell. I'm filling in for Tom Garcia. With me today is Itamar Geldman, Republican from Texas, who's running for Congress. Good afternoon, Itamar. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Jill. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, tell me, what part of Texas are you running for?
I'm running in District 25, the new U.S. Congressional District 25. It's a district that stretched from the north side. The north part is just south of Fort Worth in Tarrant County and goes all the way down to Hays County, including parts of Austin.
Great, including Central Austin as well?
Yes, Central Austin and West Austin, a little bit of East North Austin. It's kind of like an upside, it's kind of like a U-shape, a small U-shape inside Austin.
Okay. Great. What's the biggest county there that you're representing?
The biggest county is Johnson County. It's the county on the north part of the district.
What's the population over there?
It's about 150,000 people.
Great. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself, Itamar. I know that you're an American Israeli, and why don't you give us a little history on yourself and what brought you to the Texas area and why you're running for Congress?
Okay. I was born in New York when I was a young kid. When I was in my early ages, I was about between 5 to 6 years old, we moved to Israel, where I grew up. I served in the Israeli military, and I served in the Israeli police department as a reserve. After the military, I moved back to the United States. I actually got a job bodyguarding a few celebrities and doing some security training and advising for corporation and celebrities and executives. And I just loved my country back, so I stayed here. And about 6 years ago, I started investing in real estate in Texas, which I moved to Texas to start doing that. And ever since, I have both my company in California and real estate in Texas.
Super. And what did you do? That's very interesting that you served in the Israeli army. What did you do for them?
I served as a lieutenant. I started with the Special Forces unit, and later on I moved to more in the tactical advising / strategy when I became an officer, and, you know, planning missions, planning consequences, planning war games, and see what planning for the worst and hoping for the best, and looking what can go wrong. As a guy that was an operator, I can bring my input from being in the field to teach and learn from my experience on what can go wrong.
Interesting. Well, joining us now is Craig Sawyer. Craig's a tactical expert himself. Hi, Craig. Thanks for joining us.
How are you, Jill? Thanks for having me back. Things
sure.
Are well.
We're talking with Itamar Geldman. Itamar is American Israeli who served in Special Forces in Israel, and he's running for Congress in a district that encompasses all of Johnson County in Texas, as well as central and western parts of the city of Austin. I know, Craig, you might have some questions for him, and I know that being a tactical expert yourself, what do you think he can bring to Congress, having that background?
Well, I think he can bring an enormous contribution to Congress, and we welcome people who are acting in good faith to represent the tax-paying citizens of the country. It seems like anymore the citizens are their wishes and their voice is being ignored. So anybody that gets in there that acts in good faith, that actually represents what the people want, is going to be a hit. And I've actually met Itamar at a meeting a few months back, and it was a pleasure, and it was good meeting you here as well, Itamar.
Good meeting you too, and good talking to you again.
Well, that's you
and
know,
thank you and thank you very much for the. I'm sorry. Thank you very much for the compliment as well. I appreciate it.
Sure. I was just thinking that in regards to, you know, representing the people these days, it's nice to know that somebody who has had boots on the ground and has been involved in the military is actually interested enough to go sit and do some politics. What do you think, Craig? I'm just going to ask you, Craig, real quick. What do you think the major issues are for Texas, in your opinion, since you're in a border town yourself?
Well, I don't think because I've been gone so long, I mean, Texas is still home for me and most of my family, but I don't think I'm qualified to comment on the politics there. But I do know they're a border state, and they're dealing with quite a bit of issue with neighboring Mexico and all of the activity that's involved in that. And someone like Itamar with international experience and having proven himself in military special operations is used to living by a certain code of ethic and conduct and honorability, and I would expect him to do well. So it's encouraging to see guys like him throwing his hat in the ring and saying, yeah, I'll serve, you know, put me in there and I'll do the right thing.
Yeah, Itamar, what do you think the biggest issue is for Texas?
The biggest issue for Texas, and as well as for the entire nation, is the border security. Having the border exposed like that and having it not secured is a problem. You know, you have drug dealers, you have terrorists coming through the border every day, and it's not one or two that cross the border every day. You're talking about hundreds and thousands of people that are crossing the border every day illegally. And terrorists, actually, you know, suicide bombers and sleep cells are going to the border. They're bringing in some ABC, which is atomic biological and chemical weapons. True, and they do it wide open. And they don't even hide it. They even put videos on YouTube showing how they go through the border with those chemical weapons and explaining exactly how they're going to attack the next attack. They're showing on YouTube saying, well, the next attack, you guys are doing airport security, you guys are focusing on airplanes. The next attack is not going to be in an airplane. The next attack is going to be pouring a chemical weapon into a water reservoir and killing 100,000 people in 2 minutes. And no one pays attention to that. And you can say a lot of things about extreme Islam, but the one thing that we do know about them from history is when they say something, they usually do that regarding attacks. So if they go and say wide open, yeah, this is how we're going to attack you, this is probably how they will attack us. And us not paying attention to that and not doing anything to solve that, that's how much they think of us, because they do it. They tell us right in front of our faces what they're going to do, and we're not doing anything to stop it.
Wow. Well, that leads into what we're going to be talking to Anthony Schaefer about later at 4:30 today, and what he discovered as an intelligence officer prior to 9/11. And this is an ongoing issue. What do you think we can do about it? I mean, obviously, if they're not taking these threats seriously and they're not allowing our intelligence to be useful for local law enforcement, what do you think you can do to help solve that problem?
Well, first of all, I think we need to withdraw our military boys from conflict that we shouldn't be involved in. Sending our troops to Pakistan and Libya is a waste of time and money. Those troops should be protecting Americans in American territory rather than the Libyan regime and the Libyan groups against their government, against Gaddafi. We're fighting a war that is going to lose anyway. No matter what we do over there, we're going to lose, and we're going to lose money, we're going to lose soldiers, we're going to lose our heroes' lives, and that war is not going to benefit us whatsoever. It's a lose-lose situation going to Libya. So we need to bring back our troops from Libya and Pakistan and put them on our borders until we solve the broader problem. one of the things that another thing that the United States is not doing well right now is we have a country that is our best ally that has been dealing with border issues for over 60 years, and it's Israel. And we don't have any teams working with Israel to see what they're doing to save the border over there. You know, Israel is dealing with the border security for, as I said, over 60 years. They deal with the tunnels, they deal with the smuggling, they deal with every single thing that exists, and they have that experience, they have the technology to fight with that, and we're not doing anything to learn from their mistakes. We're saying, well, we know they exist, but we want to learn from our own mistakes. Well, learning from our own mistakes is going to be very dangerous. It's a very dangerous game that we're playing on the border here, because we don't have time and we don't have money and energy and the safety of our people to deal with just let's learn from our own experience.
Yeah. Craig, what's your situation in Arizona? What do you see happening on the border? I know that you just filmed a trailer that should be picked up here shortly by one of the major cable stations regarding the border situation called Hell's Crossing. What did you find when you were making that documentary trailer?
Well, we found more of what Itamar is explaining to you that's going on in Israel. We've got a hardened, dedicated enemy, and they're hard at work exploiting our weakness. We've got our pants down around our ankles when it comes to our own borders. You know, we've got so much money and manpower extended halfway around the globe, and we refuse, it seems, to defend ourselves right here at home. And we're seeing major narco trafficking, human trafficking, and violence at the borders and well within inside the borders now. And they're setting up major pipelines to funnel massive loads of narcotics to every corner of the United States. And it's just they're driving across in trucks. We have border checkpoints, and we've got some security measures out there, but there are huge gaping holes in it. They're coming across the reservations where they're unchecked on the border side, on the Mexico side, and they come to the reservations on the American side where there's no check again. So they're just that's one of the ways that they're just coming in entirely unchallenged. And it's not just happy families that want to come across and pick fruit for cheap. You know, I mean, that's been what we saw so long ago. But for people to tell us that that's all that's going on now is a deliberate campaign of misinformation or disinformation. I mean, I talk to my own family members here who run ranches, and they'll tell you, we used to bring water out to families who were stranded that were smuggling themselves across, you know, because they'd get out there and get dehydrated, and we'd wait with them and give them water and food and wait till Border Patrol got there and rescued them. Well, now they're having guys come across in teams with AK-47s and backpacks full of drugs, and they don't want water, they don't want food, they want your cell phone so they can call their connection to get their vehicle pickup on this side. So it's a huge organized effort, and we're looking really stupid. And I think if the American public understood how vulnerable we were and what all is going on deliberately against us right now at our expense, people would be outraged, and they should know. They should be informed. And for that information to be suppressed is really treasonous. So what all's behind it, we may not ever find out, but we do need to expose it and deal with it quickly.
Right. Itamar, would you say that this is a correct statement then, and Craig, I'd like to get your feedback as well, that Americans truly think that we are fighting Al-Qaeda, we are fighting the Taliban over on their turf in order to keep it from our homeland. But in fact, they're already here, they're already living amongst us, and by not securing our borders and realizing that we need to fight this war in our own homeland now versus on their turf, that they're putting their heads in the sand. They're just ostriches thinking, oh, it's not here. It can't happen to me.
Oh, definitely. absolutely correct. It's that's one of the problems that we have. We're setting the border patrol, and our local law enforcement don't have the rights to check their legal status of people, and everyone think it's an Hispanic problem. It's not an Hispanic problem. No one is looking into the Hispanics into that. It's more into real secure of America. It's not about working here or coming to make a dream here. We're talking about it escalated to a whole different level of terrorism, inside terrorism, and we can't stop it now because they're already inside us. They're already in our cities. They already have sleeper cells here. They're already moving here, and we need to focus a lot of our intelligence inside our country. Our local police departments don't have the budget, and Border Patrol don't have the budget of what the military has. So when you're sending Border Patrol to stop them, or you're sending law enforcement, again, like Craig said, we're sending them with the 9mm handguns while they're having 50 caliber rifles and automatic guns, and which, by the way, some of it, we gave them some of it. So it's, the problem is inside is getting bigger and bigger inside our country, and that we need to fix.
Do you think the Patriot Act is going to help with some of that? Do you think it's going to harm us as a society more than it can help us at this point? In regards to being able to, you know, get shake somebody down, regardless, just if you have any type of suspicion of who they are or what they might be doing, you know, the ability to follow them, the ability to, you know, enter without warrant, that sort of thing. Do you think it's a good, that it has to be, that we have to keep it, or do you think it should have tighter reins on it?
I think it would be great if we keep it. We need to be able to check those guys, but we also need to learn from other countries what they're doing with that. And for example, in Israel, in Israel it's legal to profile. So yeah, we need to understand. Yes, the Patriotic Act is necessary for the safety of Americans, but going around and searching every single house, that's not what we're looking to do here. And if we can't profile people and profile who's doing the bomb and who's attacking, and that's one of the problems that we have, is if we can profile, then and you see it in airports all the time, if you see a Muslim, you don't see the airport security going to extreme Muslims and check them out. They're going to the white guys, they're going to the Caucasian, they're going to the blacks, they're going to the Hispanic, because they're being afraid of being called, racist and getting sued for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I support it, but also we need to focus on how we do it and where do we do it. We can't just go and search every single person's house. That's not what we need to do.
Right. So you think the Israelis have it right? They've come down after 60 years. They've figured this out, and they could teach us something. What is there anything in particular that you've learned by being embedded in that society and having grown up there that they're doing innately that we're not?
Yeah, profiling, for example, it's one of them, and learning how they behave and. What we're chasing against. We're too scattered. We don't have a focus on what we're looking for as America. They didn't put together a plan on how to stop it, or who we're looking for and how we're looking it for. We give them too much right. We give them too much. Oh, they're just peaceful people that they want to have. They want to make a living here, or they want to show us their side, and Sharia law is a good issue. No, I mean, if you read Sharia law, it says in black and white that if you're either a Muslim or you're an enemy, and if you're an enemy, we need to kill you. So going around and say, oh, they're just peaceful and they're looking for help and we need to help them, no, that's not going to happen. We need to look exactly what we need to do and how to do it. And focus on who is our real enemy here and fight them.
Mm-hmm. How, Craig, what do you think? Who are our enemies in the U.S. these days?
Well, you know, we have a document that was designed by our founding fathers to protect us. We are the country. The citizens are the United States. And anybody who wants to dismantle or attack that protection of us is our enemy. Now, and they take lots of shapes, whether they be foreign or domestic. If they're looking to dismantle and tear down that United States Constitution, they have made themselves an enemy of the United States. And there's some strange occurrences going on now where people that you wouldn't expect to act in such a manner are actually deliberately tearing down everything that we have, everything that's precious to us. You know, if you look at Israel, man, back to your previous question with effectiveness, Israel's a small country. They've got their backs to the sea and surrounded by hostile enemies. They don't have the luxury of playing political correctness. They must do what's effective or perish, because all of their enemies want them to cease to exist and have stated so and act accordingly. So Israel must do what's effective. And luxuries like pretending to be politically correct are luxuries that they cannot afford. Now, we are still so big and so powerful, we're accustomed to getting away with being ineffective. You know, we're so powerful, we do things, we're disjointed, we're not united anymore in a lot of ways, and it's unfortunate, and we should return more to what works. This whole idea of being politically correct is, I see it as an attack on us, because it paralyzes us, it cripples us from being effective at things. Because what is political correctness? Is it to treat all people equal? No, it's to treat those who have been abused before better than those who have been abusing them, and so the pendulum swings wildly from one side to the next. If it's correct, everybody is genuinely treated the same, and you do what's effective and you do what works. And the sooner we get to that realization, the sooner we can begin saving ourselves, because right now there's damage being done to us that hasn't yet revealed itself. If you've got 35 admitted Al-Qaeda training camps inside the continental United States, and you've got the FBI publishing reports of nuclear materials being brought in to the United States by Al-Qaeda for the purpose of attacking us, and we've got politicians that refuse to acknowledge and address and deal with that issue because they want someone's votes, then American citizens have been sold down the river. Of all colors, creeds, shapes, and sizes. So yeah. I think we've got to do what works, regardless of what you call it at this point. Because if we don't wake up and set about doing what's effective soon, we're gonna lose our entire way of life, because our enemies have no sense of humor about failure. They want us gone, and they're busy making it happen, and it just hasn't all revealed itself yet.
Yeah, I know that, you know, there's all kinds of different ways to take down a country, and one of them is financially. And the state of the union today, with so many people being on entitlement services, social welfare, you know, unemployment, and so on and so forth, it's scary to know that we're so far in debt that by reducing those programs, we're leaving people, a lot of people, high and dry. At the same time, we're not able to continue and sustain what we're doing now. Itamar, in your area, do you have any idea what a percentage of the population is living on these entitlements? Is it a very depressed area that you're...
No, it's not a very depressed area. Texas is pretty much the only state that was able to sustain and gain some financial stability. And get some corporation moving in, and it's because of their tax system. I agree with, we need to cancel the entitlement. I don't think we'll leave them dry. As I used to manage a lot of properties that were used to be Section 8, and if you know Section 8, seeing that every day, I saw how much fraud that system has. How many of those people just don't even want to work? It doesn't work for them to work. Because if they go to work, they make $7 an hour. And if you calculate it in a monthly, they make, okay, $1,500 a month. If they stay home and don't work and complain that to the state or to the country, they get free rent, which that's automatically about $600-$700. Plus they get food stamps, they get unemployment, they get free medical, free everything. And they actually make more money staying home and complaining than going to work. So I think there is enough work out there for people to go to work. They just don't want to. They're lazy. It's easier. The country reward them for not working. It reward them to be lazy instead of telling them to go to work, instead of advancing them or cheering them to go to work. That's how it is. And I can give hundreds of examples of personal experience that I've seen with people about how much they fraud the system and they lie. And there's a lot of emails going on lately with pictures of people with food stamps that are buying steaks for lunch in Walmart. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so you're saying, okay, you're unemployed and you don't have any money, but you have enough money to go and buy a $30 steak for lunch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think it's...
I don't know. When I moved back here after the military and I had $1,500 in my pocket, I didn't eat steak for 6 months. I drank water from tap water, and I ate the cheapest food I can find. I didn't barbecue myself steaks and went to restaurants on food stamps.
Yeah. So it's a systematic. It's a systematic issue. I mean, there are people that need the help when they're at their very lowest and would not abuse the system by any means, and then there's others that make a living doing so. Do you think that in regards to immigration, that Texas has a handle on that, or what's your advice on what to do about Texas immigration?
It's the same problem all over the country. The immigrants that came here already. I don't think amnesty is the answer. It's you came here illegal, and you know what? That you're done. It's I don't support anything that is illegal, or I don't support anything that is illegal. Yeah. So I don't support amnesty. You can't if you want to come here. There's more than enough options of coming here legally. And one of the problems that we have with the immigration is they don't want to fit into our society. They don't want to learn English. It's easier for them to say, well, it's hard for us. You learn Spanish instead of us learning English. You know, this is a country that for over 200 years we spoke English here. You know, if you come here the legal way and fit into our environment, we don't need to change to fit into to your environment.
Yeah. Well, you seem like a really good example for that, Itamar, that you've made this your home, that you've got experience overseas, you have some insights as to what the major issues are here in the United States, and it sounds like you've got a real handle on what's going on in Texas, and we really appreciate you coming on and talking with us today, and we're going to have Tony Schaefer on here shortly. If you'd like to hang around and ask some questions of him, he's coming to us after the House Armed Services Committee today, where he watched and helped with some of the folks who were testifying, and I think he's going to have some real interesting insights as to what our plan and strategies are over in Afghanistan, but, of course, that obviously affects Pakistan and the Middle Eastern crisis in general.
Two quick comments. Regarding the unemployment, I'm not saying if people work and they lost their job because of the economy, I don't say, okay, everyone are cheating the system. That's not what I was saying. I'm saying there are more than enough people that do that, and people that don't do it, yeah, I support helping them to get back on their feet, but it needs to get to the point that we're supporting them to help them get on their feet and not to make it as a living.
Sure.
That's one. And sure. Second is any listener, I would love to, if you can go on my website and email me, tell me more what you think, comments, emails, My website is GelmanForCongress.com. It's G-E-L, B like Bravo, M-A-N, for Congress, and is one word, .com.
That's great. And you can always find us on Blog Talk Radio. We have your information on our flyer there. Also, guests can call in and ask questions at 310-982-4145. Thank you, Itamar. And now I'd like to
introduce
Lieutenant...
Thank you very much, Jill.
You're welcome. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer with us. Hey, Tony, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
Good, good. Well, I didn't have a planned introduction for you, but Craig knows a little bit about you as well. Craig, how can you introduce our friend Tony here?
Inadequately. I'll put a word on it. Tony's got more qualification, certainly, than I can recount, but he's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on at multiple levels, and perhaps we should allow Tony to kind of outline what capacities he operates in and what all he's involved in. But Fox News has him on regularly to find out what's going on, because Tony's right there in the mix. So it's certainly an honor to be on with him, and I think we should just ask Tony to kind of outline real quickly what it is that he does.
Well, thanks, Craig, and thanks, Joe. I appreciate being on. To summarize it, I just retired this past Thursday with 30 and a half years in the Guard, Reserve, and Active Component combined. And then, I got asked the day by someone about what do I do now. It's kind of like, well, you know, I guess the best way of putting it now, I'm a think tank guy. I just came from a think tank, and while I'm on the media a lot, as Craig mentioned, I do Fox, I do MSNBC, CNN, we do the full spectrum as the spokesman for the Center for Advanced Defense Studies. I also work with something called Impact America, which is an organization where I'm a senior fellow with. We actually do work relating to electromagnetic pulse, which is EMP in short, relating to both natural threats, sunspots, once you take out the power grid, as well as man-made sources. And then also in my past life, I was a senior intelligence officer. Some would call us operators. Where I worked with Defense Intelligence Agency, Army Intelligence, and Air Force Intelligence for about 20 years as a civilian, working the full spectrum of operations, which Craig and I know well, can't talk about much in public. So that's, I guess, the best summary of kind of what I do now and where I've come from. So that's, and of course, as Jill mentioned, I spent three glorious hours today on the Hill listening to the musings of two general officers and former Assistant Secretary of Defense, former Marine Corps Colonel Bing West. So of the three, Bing was the only guy that made any sense. So with that said, I just got to set it up for your questions. How are you going to go next?
Well, thanks, Tony. I actually had a little bit of time to download the YouTube of the hearings this morning, and I have to agree with you there. Yeah. Well, Bing always makes sense. In fact, Bing's got a fantastic book out. I'm hoping that we can get him on one day. It's called The Raw War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. And Tony himself has written a book as well in regards to his experiences in Afghanistan, and it is called Operation Dark Heart. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book, Tony?
Sure. Well, as a matter of fact, one of the principal bad guy characters in my book, Lieutenant General David Barno, testified today. So it was with great interest I heard his words of semi-competence as he testified. Now that I'm retired, I feel like I can be a lot more direct about how I really feel about things.
Sure.
We had some real, you know, we've had some real issues for the past 10 years in Afghanistan. And my book covers two specific events. First, what most would call the tipping point from where we went from winning to losing. From when we basically switched strategies. In testimony today, David Barno, who I worked for part of the time there, actually admitted that he was the first guy to adapt to what is now known as the counterinsurgency strategy. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. And the other issue, which also came out today, which I cover extensively in my book, is the fact that we knew as early as 2003 with a great deal of clarity, much of which we talk about in the book regarding the intel which drove our knowledge, that the real issue is Pakistan, that all the real leadership for the insurgency, all the people who are actually effective in retooling the Taliban are in Pakistan. And so arguably, it was noted today during the hearings, has been noted for the past 6 years, that no matter how well we do in Afghanistan, it doesn't really matter. Because as long as the safe havens exist in Pakistan, Bing West talked about two of the explosive factories that we know about being located in Pakistan, which manufacture the very explosives which are killing our troops. And so this knowledge goes back to 2003, and my book actually covers in great detail why we knew with credible intelligence back in 2003 that this was the key issue of the war. And frankly, ever since then, everybody's talked about it, but been willing to do virtually nothing about the key and direct causal factors why, no matter how well our troops do, and don't get me wrong, the troops have done a fabulous job at what they've been asked to do over the past years relating to securing certain elements, certain locations within Afghanistan. But no matter how well they do, they will never defeat the enemy because they can't defeat the enemy because the enemy is able to retool, reorganize, and continue to launch operations from Pakistan. And that is the focus, that is the premise of my book and why I'd like to believe, one of the reasons it was a bestseller last year.
Well, it is a great book, and I've got to say I've read it, and it's very eye-opening. In fact, it made me actually want to learn more about Afghanistan and about the situation and the strategy over there. And then most recently, Craig and I have had the distinct pleasure of getting to know our recent Medal of Honor nominee, Dakota Meyer, and his particular story took place in the eastern Konar province, which borders Pakistan. And he's a prime example, and his firefight in Ganjgal is a prime example of what happens when the strategy isn't working and the sit-down shuras are not the end-all be-all of how we're going to have three cups of tea with military wives, basically. And
right.
That he was attacked from the eastern flank, and they knew that they were exposed, but they didn't do anything about it. And unfortunately, I think everything that could go wrong went wrong in his situation, mm-hmm. all the way from the fact they didn't have the proper leadership to miscommunications on the radios, resources diverted north, which happened a third of the time, you know, apparently. So everything that could go wrong did go wrong. But Bing West describes it much in the same way that you describe it in your book. And Pakistan, you know, and I'm sorry, I'm going to go on for a minute, but in Pakistan, it gives them a hiding place. So they can run across the border, hide, and then attack us on our own turn. You know, after they get their intel, they can sit and wait and be embedded for our troops. And
right.
And how are we going to solve that problem if we're not occupying Pakistan?
Well, there's some ways. I'm glad you brought that up. And just to hit a couple of hot points which came out of the hearings today for the audience. We're talking about, and this is interesting, I just want to retool for a second the whole strategy issue. And I know it's one of the things you asked me to talk about a little bit. And this actually came up. Part of the congresswoman actually asked General Keane, former chief of staff of the Army, "General, you know, we've heard about the counterterrorism strategy versus the coin strategy. What's the difference?"
Mm-hmm.
And Keane actually had, you know, this is critical, and this is something, you know, if it's on YouTube, you can watch this. He basically says, "Well, there's really no difference. They're really interchangeable and related." And it's like he went on to explain how there's really no difference. It's like it just showed how there is really no clear policy here. And his answer
right.
was indicative of the chaos which is being caused. And let me tell you something. You know, I've done this a day or two. There is a huge difference between counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. Counterinsurgency, for all intents and purposes, is nation building. This was said by Bing West today. And God bless Bing for being the real, only rational. And one of the other congressmen commented, is like, basically, you know, he said, Colonel West, you're the only one who's basically not speaking as part of the bureaucracy because you're talking about the truth. And that's the issue here. They've muddled the strategy so badly that you have a former chief of staff of the Army basically saying, "Well, there's really no difference." Well, there is a huge difference. And basically, COIN is, and if the audience can basically kind of put this together in their own minds, coin equals nation building. And during one of the questions, during the questioning today, the question came up, are we still doing nation building? And of course, Charles Keene said, no, we're not. General Barno said, of course we're not. And then Bing said, oh, now, yeah, we are. Nothing has changed. I've been over there a number of times, and we continue to do things like trying to create ministries for the betterment of women, trying to actually enable, all these different reforms which relate to our version of society rather than what the Afghan people are used to or actually want. So we continue to make huge investments in the infrastructure that are really designed to do nation building and not the bottom line, which should be, and all three generals, all three individuals said this, two generals said this, but their testimony was opposite of it. They all said we should be in the job of protecting our nation, not building other nations. And frankly, that's the issue here. We don't have a clear path forward, and that's why right now I spend a whole lot of time on the Hill working with the policymakers on trying to resolve this and actually help try to establish, surprise, surprise, believe it or not, there are actually congressmen on the Hill who want this. They really do want to try to establish a clear path forward that is both economically sound and is a clear, very well-articulated strategy for what we're doing in the region, not only Afghanistan, but the whole region. And this is one of the things I'll say real quick, Jill, and I'll let you get back to your questions. We just continue to fail to recognize the real core issue. Pakistan has 130 million people, and they've got over 100 nuclear weapons. Afghanistan has 30 million, and they're a basket case. So you tell me which area we should be really focusing on more. It's kind of counterintuitive, but we've continued to neglect the real issues, which are Pakistan, both in perspective of the safe havens and the real threats. Every threat that we've dealt with since 9/11 relating to al-Qaeda have come in some form either from Pakistan or have been influenced from Pakistan.
Yeah. Well, and do you think that we should be, in regards to having such a major debt crisis right now, do you think that we should be focusing our military dollars here at home or in Pakistan and in that Middle East? Where do you think we're going to be best protected, I should say?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked that. Let me put it this way. If we cut the budget in half for Afghanistan, we cut everything in half, focused on special operations as our primary objective, which really, if you use special operations, you're focusing on anti-terrorism, you're doing more of the bin Laden type stuff, bin Laden raids type stuff. If we cut it in half, we would be five times more efficient and 10 times more effective. Now, you may scratch your head and say, well, how is that possible? Well, it's possible by the fact that we have layered, we have put layers of bureaucracy into the country. We have so many layers now, and this was actually came up regarding questioning on something called rules of engagement. This has been a hotly debated topic, which, again, I would encourage your listeners, if they want to get more information, this came as one of the hot-button issues as well. Basically, because we have so many layers of bureaucracy, what is said at the top is often changed two and three times. So by the time it gets down to the soldier on the field, he's got so many rules, he doesn't know what to do. And this is affecting our ability to conduct military operations. So you're going to love this. And this is why I think it's so instructive of being there and listening to this. Both General Keene and General Barno got direct questions on this by, I guess it was Senator Joe, I'll think of his name in a second, from South Carolina. And he said,
I remember this.
Yeah, and he said, General, I got to ask about this, our troops being affected by bad rules of engagement. And both generals said, oh, no, that's not an issue. And Ben West, God bless him again, said, yeah, it is an issue. It's a huge issue because we have so many layers. And by the way, when that's translated at the bottom, we can't capture anybody. Because we are so afraid of doing the right thing, we either kill people or we have to turn them over to the locals and they get released again. It's like the catch and release program. So again, we have the two talking heads talking about the military official position and the reality which people like Craig and I are often faced with, you know, the guys at the pointy end of the spear, it's completely different when it gets down there. And these two generals are so out of touch. It takes someone like a Bing West who actually goes in there, and God bless him, has no official military standing, to go in there and discover what's going on. Joe Wilson, by the way, was the congressman who asked that question, Joe Wilson. And so it was instructive, again, like as I mentioned, to actually have Bing West tell the truth. And it's very uncomfortable to sit there, and I'm sitting there right behind him. I stayed, by the way, I stayed purposely out of camera. You'll see my hand occasionally behind Bing West, you know, moving around. But I was there literally just steaming at some of these answers because I know they're patently false. And this has been the problem for the past 10 years. And the bottom line was the two generals were basically asking for more time. We just need one more season. We just need one more, you know, go at this, and it'll get right. And the bottom line, the sad fact is this. It's another form of insanity. To do the same thing over and over again with the same people and somehow expect a different result is truly insane. And that's what we're faced with at this point in time.
Well, and I did remember hearing General Keane making an excuse for not having success on the ground, in that it's somewhere in the middle of the telephone chain
right.
is where the breakdown in communication is. So of course nobody at the highest levels is going to take any responsibility for this, you know, and for the nation building strategy in general, which is what they're being fed at the highest levels, and it's just filtering on down. So if you're going to tell us that your mid-level colonels are, and your mid-level colonel and your lieutenant colonels are risk adversive, I find that very hard to believe, simply because they're the ones out there whose boys are, their lives are on the line. They're going to be the ones who are making the smarter decisions. So I truly feel like, as an American citizen, it is a bunch of crap, because I know that at the highest levels, they are still doing the counterinsurgency strategy, and that's going to filter all the way down, and it's risk adversive, and our enemy doesn't understand that. They only understand brave warriors. They don't understand the diplomacy that we're trying to bring to them, and obviously we're never going to be able to build their nation.
Right, and I think that, and Bing West really said it well today. I mean, and this is where he and I tend to disagree, and this is where, at the end of the testimony today, Bing West was asked about, what do you view the path forward as, you know, what's the most important thing? And basically Bing West said, well, it's the continuation of the Afghan army. And this is where he and I disagree. He said basically that is the one thing that's going to hold the country together. Then he got a question which everybody kind of stood up and take notice. And the question was this: well, isn't the Afghan army multicultural? Don't they have a lot of different individuals from different tribes? And will they hold together? And it was like a stunned moment. It's like, we really don't know. And we don't know. But the bottom line is, it's time for us to let them go and fight. If they're going to fight, if they're going to remain cohesive, they've got to do that. And by the way, this is something that Bing West said. I've been talking to one of the four-star general directly, one other through one of the congressmen dealing with. This was, we've learned a lot of lessons from Vietnam. And one of the things that happened in Vietnam is that as long as U.S. units were next to Vietnamese units, U.S. units always fought. Bing West said that today it's going on in Afghanistan. If you have a U.S. Marine Corps unit and an Afghan Army unit side by side, the U.S. military unit, the Marines, are always going to take the lead and go do it because they're most effective. That's not the right answer. The time is now for the Afghans to step up to do their own security. And the bottom line is, they may not hold together, but that may not be a bad thing. It really needs to be the Afghan. And Joe, you sent me a couple things recently relating to the young kid being used to be the IED, you know, being tested to see how effective IEDs are. You know, that should make the Afghan people fighting mad. That should make them rise up against the Taliban. And let me say this from my direct personal experience. When I was there in 2003, the Afghan people were happy to have the Taliban gone. What we've done, we've actually put them in the middle of two bad choices. We've made them, we're forcing them to choose between a corrupt central government, which Ryan Crocker, the current ambassador, called a second insurgency. In his hearings recently, he said that. So we're making them pick between the Karzai government, which is seen as hugely corrupt and ineffective, and the Taliban. So we need to give the Afghan people a third choice. And they are primarily tribal. They do not recognize or live within a 21st century Western construct. That's not a bad thing. They're not ungoverned. They are self-governed. We need to allow them, and this was actually talked about too. There's been something called the village support effort being done, where you actually work village to village to allow villages to kind of self-organize. The village elder pick who's in charge, and they rise up amongst themselves. I call it a tribal uprising, similar to what happened with the Sunni uprising or Sunni awakening in Iraq. We've got to go down that path. That is truly the cheapest. This goes back to your question about the economy. It's much cheaper to have them do this. One of the other things to go to the economic question, Bing West said, right now we are faced with a situation where for every U.S. soldier, there's two Afghans in country. We need to change that ratio so that for every U.S. soldier, there's 10 Afghans. It's really time for them to pick it up, and you don't need 100,000 conventional armed forces to do that sort of thing at this point.
Right. Well, I know that Bing also has the theory that we should, reduce forces to possibly, I think, 10,000 and really set them up with more of these training teams, advisory
yes.
teams.
Right.
Teams much like what Corporal Dakota Meyer was a part of. And,
yes.
they basically help train these Afghan groups who do want to fight the Taliban or, take back their government. And we just basically support them. And is that the same kind
right.
of scenario that you're suggesting we were doing back in 2003?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I was there, we were really focused on a special forces war. The special forces were out in their base camps working with locals to do what was necessary to help them. Locals really do the job of keeping the Taliban out. And this is one of the things I've talked about before also in my book. We won the war in 2002 by the Afghan militia forces. People tend to forget that we did not have a large land invasion of Afghanistan. It wasn't practical, nor would I ever recommend it. We essentially used the warlords and other tribes to essentially throw off the yoke of the Taliban. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with actually allowing the warlords to side with themselves, to actually throw off this? So this is where I argue we don't necessarily have to go as far as having a centrally controlled manned army. We need to look at how we won in 2002 and go back to that. And this is where, again, where Bing and I kind of separate a little bit. I think that he thinks a central army is necessary. I don't. I think that just having tribes who understand that, hey, having an extremist organization like the Taliban does not do them any favors. And frankly, one of the things that Bing West did say, and I agree with 100%, the Taliban, no matter how you cut it, don't have the momentum. They don't have the mass to overthrow the central government, nor will they ever at this point. So I think the idea that we have to maintain a central military in Kabul is not necessary. I think that things will right themselves as long as we give the Afghan people the resources and chance to right their own ship and go forward.
Well, I know that General Keane also was talking about, I think in response to Senator Davis from California, was asking about the 60% to 70% illiterate rate of
right.
the Afghan people and the training that would be involved in helping them become their own military force. And
right.
he described them as enablers, that we need to be enablers. There's also, enablers that are there now that are a totally different breed, but we would become enablers for that. And that there was $6 billion allocated for that. Is that $6 billion to NATO? Because he broke it down that there was $3 billion allocated to the U.S., which sounded like that was for our training programs for them.
My impression is you're correct. And $6 billion is the basic money set aside for that. But there are huge problems with it. First, despite the rosy briefing about the existence of, somewhere between 160,000 to 200,000 Afghan army, they are losing, from my understanding, between 6,000 to 7,000 troops a month. That is to say that they have to replace that number because of the attrition rate, because of people just deserting. So that's not sustainable. Secondly, the other issue, as you mentioned, this came up, we're going to have a few C-130s. I think Keane actually said this. We have to have a few C-130s flying around. Yeah, we, because the Afghan people generally do not have the ability to do that. They have not had the ability to generate educated officers sufficiently able to work high technology pieces of gear. This is the sad truth. It's not. I'm not saying this as a pejorative of the Afghan people, but I would say between 85 to 90% of the Afghan people do not read or write any language, and there's a percentage somewhere between 70 and 80 who can't even enumerate. Literally, they have to take their shoes off to count to 20. And I'm not joking about that. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying that's the way it is. So for us to believe that we can take the fabric of Afghan society and turn them into a 21st century stable democracy is insane. And this is where Bing West gets it right. And the other two generals are, for all intents and purposes, totally either by design or by ignorance, intellectually dishonest about the realities we face there.
Well, I see it as kind of a liberal point of view that, you know, they're giving them the benefit of the doubt of, you know, being capable of learning an entire language and military strategy and how to operate weapons all in the same day.
Right.
But I think you're right. I think that from what I've read, it sounds as if they've always been a very transient people in regards to how they deal with their issues. They're very tribal.
Right.
They're farmers. They're nomads.
It's not a bad thing.
No.
It's not a bad thing. And this is one of the things, too, that is notable. When I was outside the wire quite a bit, and I would pass on convoys going in between Kabul and Bagram. And I'm not joking about this, Jill, and Craig maybe knows this, too. The Kuchi tribe. There's actually a Kuchi tribe in Afghanistan. They live in the Kuchi Mountains. And these folks have lived the same way literally for 1,000 years. And you would see these families migrating in the spring from their winter home to the summer home with the children in brightly dressed red, green, blue outfits, everything they owned on the back of camels. And you know what? They didn't care that we were there. We left them alone. They left us alone. And a lot of the Afghan people are like that. They don't want to be governed by the central government. They don't want to be governed by the Taliban. All we need to do, I believe, is really encourage their own independent, well, you know, if you will, I hope you guys don't get phone calls about this. They're kind of like the Tea Party. I mean, they just want to be left alone. They want to have independence to live their lives the way they do, and they don't want to be told either side how to do that.
Right. And they'll play either side, from what I understand. Why don't you tell me a little bit about how,
absolutely,
you know,
yes,
how do they play? Just give us a scenario of a father with three sons. For example.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's two little stories I'll tell real quick, and we'll get going here. But first off, there are some fathers who have, for example, if they have three sons, they will literally hedge their bets. They will have one son serving in the Afghan army. They will have another son actually working in the Taliban. And then they'll have a third son staying at home farming. And I've heard stories. A good friend of mine who actually works for ABC News now, I'll keep his name out of this, was actually embedded with the Taliban about 5 years ago. And he told me a story, and he was actually on an attack with the Taliban. He said one of these Taliban called his brother, who was in the Afghan army, the day before an attack, and said, "Hey, tomorrow morning we're going to attack your facility. Don't shoot over to the left. That's where I'm going to be." Now think about that. I mean, you know... This is how insane the situation is there, where you have literally brothers fighting each other, and often it's just for show.
Well, and the father is taking work from the Americans on base at the same time he's, you know, feeding counterintelligence to the Taliban and getting paid for that. So it's very difficult to know who you're dealing with. I know Colonel Ayub, who was the colonel for the Afghan fighters, over there in the Ganjgal province area, had said this to – he was a border police commander, and he offered his solution on how to solve the problems with the Taliban coming back and forth across the border in Pakistan. You know, his solution was use B-52s.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all they understand.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that's all they understand.
Well, let me close this one little thing. Today, General Barno, who, you know, obviously I don't agree with hardly at all, said that his vision was that there's just three things necessary for victory. Now, keep in mind, his vision has not achieved any victory yet, but he said it again today. He says, well, the three things necessary is the right strategy with the right leadership and resources. And him saying that, I just cringe. It's like, oh, my God, he still doesn't get it. The right strategy with a practical understanding of the environment and the people, and then leadership. He does. He left out that component of what you just talked about. He just doesn't get it. The people we're dealing with, for the most part, still don't get it, and it's sad because we have kids dying in the process of them not getting it.
Well, we do, and let's talk about that. Let's end the show on that. Here's a little blip from what we heard earlier today, if it'll play for me, at the hearings. And
generally speaking, exceptions all over the place, to be sure. But our judgment tells us, based on experience that we've had with years in Iraq with that force and years with this force. And
General, excuse me 1 minute. We're saying to the Iraqis right now, do you want to stay there another year or two?
What our judgment is telling us is that based on what we see now with the Afghan National Security Forces, we should be encouraged and that we can go forward and begin the transition with them carefully, but begin that transition with them. And we will find out whether that judgment is correct or not. General.
What do you think about that when we're going to be losing at least 1,000 of our troops and 7,000 wounded in the next 3.5 years?
I was there for that question, and I was shocked by the apparent, just give us more time, sir. You know, it's like it's not worked so far. And don't forget, this is one of the key things, remember, this is not Iraq. What worked in Iraq has not worked so far. None of the stats show that we've had any great permanent effect. What we've done is created a fishbowl. And within that fishbowl, people are safe. Our guys are safe. We've made progress. That fishbowl is not sustainable, and the moment we walk away, the fish are going to be eaten by the sharks, and it's time that the fish figure out how to be sharks themselves or be eaten. That's kind of where we're at. And we should not have our kids bearing the brunt of the bad judgments of our leaders on this because, I'm sorry, I disagree with General Keane 110%. His judgment on this is wrong.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tony. And I know we'll love to have you back to talk some more about your book and Operation Dark Heart and Operation Able
Danger
as well.
That's coming up. More to come on that.
All right. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Take care, Tony.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Take care, Craig. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Jill, by the way.
You're welcome. Thank you, Itamar. Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still with you guys.
Isn't he very interesting? I know Tony's very interesting, and we'd love to have him back to talk more about what he learned at the 9/11, about the 9/11 issues before and after.
He's very accurate with what he said about, and it's not just with the military, with the high-ranking generals that are not connecting to the ground and what's really happening. It's also all true with the government. You know, we have congressmen that have been in office for 30, 40 years now that have absolutely no idea what it is to live in the United States that it is in this financial time and these times right now. And
yeah, they're living in an alternate universe.
Those are the guys that, you know, voting for our bills and voting for our future, and it's guys that have absolutely no clue whatsoever what's happening in the streets.
Yeah. If you have a comment, you can call in at 310-982-4145. Craig, what was your take on that? Have you heard anything new, or is that pretty much in line with what you've been hearing?
Well, I think Tony's spot on, and Itamar as well. You know, Tony's right in there in the middle of it. And I think it speaks to some of the things that we brought up earlier about the difference between Israel and the United States. Israel's small, must be effective. And we are still so large, apparently, and so powerful that a lot of our high-ranking folks don't feel like they need to roll their sleeves up and get right down in there and agonize over it and find out, hey, what is it that makes our enemies tick? What do we need to learn about the culture to be effective in Afghanistan? You know, if we really wanted to win a war, we'd be in there winning it. And it seems like we're playing games now. And with politicians that have been in there for decades and decades voting for themselves, all kinds of luxuries, it's hard to imagine how little they care anymore about the American people, because they can turn left and right and get money and grants and bonuses for all kinds of different things that don't really serve the majority of the American public at all. So I think we need to clean some house in D.C. and get people who are actually intent on serving the American citizens, and they need to recognize that, hey, we are under threat, and we are at war, so why don't we pull together and put our best foot forward and get this thing handled effectively and and get her done and get our boys home once that's been done correctly.
Yeah, Itamar, let me ask you this. I mean, in regards to we're having to talk about all these different issues, especially, you know, the border issues, on in respect to the culture in which we're operating. The culture in America is so much different than the culture in Israel. Do you think that it will ever be possible to be able to get past our political correctness and the liberalism in the media that makes people believe that, you know, having anything like the Patriot Act is just a violation of their privacy? And I understand that, you know, in a conservative point of view, we don't want to give up our rights. We don't want to give up these rights. We really don't. We don't want to go back to square one. At the same time, how are we going to manage being able to do such things as profiling without it turning around and biting us in the butt?
First of all, I want to also add to a comment that Craig said regarding our generals. For example, in the Israeli military, the officers go to fight. Just because you're a general or brigadier general or colonel doesn't mean that that's it, you're in a desk job. You had five-star generals that died in a mission in Israel. So the officers are by the first rule of officer is you setting an example. So by setting an example, you roll down your sleeves and you go. You fight in the dirt, in the mud. You don't sleep 18 hours. So you have that setting an example. So our generals and our brigadier generals, they know what's happening. Most of the Israeli politicians, you know, first of all, most of them came from nothing. They made something out of themselves. If it's through the military, or is it true a different, you know, business-oriented? But most of them didn't come from a rich family or from a politician family. You have it very loud and clear in the United States. And regarding your question, yes, we're waking up. America does wake up. The Tea Party did in 2010 an amazing job on waking up America. And they did start cleaning the House and Senate and state-level politician pretty good. We haven't finished that job, and I think we see a lot of not a career politician, people-minded people that are going for those jobs, people that are well-established on their own, that really never wanted to be politician because they didn't want to deal with being a public figure. They wanted to be behind the cameras, behind the scene, waking up and saying, that's it, I had enough with it. And they're taking charge. And you see it. You see the movement going forward to let's be done with the BS and let's start taking care of business.
Yeah. Well, I hope the American public does wake up soon and realize that we do have to fight our own battles here in our own homeland. And we got to start that with controlling our borders immediately and then clean house inside. And I think profiling is necessary on many levels, and I'm hoping that we can find ways to do it without losing our constitutional rights in other cases. I think sometimes one bad apple spoils it for the bunch, and in America, you know, all it takes is a lawsuit to make that happen, and we need to start to be more serious about how we control our politicians and how we participate in American society. Thank you both for being with us today. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, Jill, this is Craig. I think one common thread in every topic we've talked about today is character, individual character and integrity. You know, if our politicians, our generals have character, they're going to act in good faith and do what's right and seek what's right rather than serve themselves. And, you know, when we've had presidents in the past humiliating our company or our country and making moral mistakes that were embarrassing, people were saying, well, character doesn't matter for president. It's just how the economy, that's all we care about. Well, no, character is everything, because that is the only thing that's going to keep the most powerful man on the face of the planet from hooking himself up at our expense with all the opportunities that he's got. We need our representatives to be people of strong character. That's why I welcome those from the military who have had to demonstrate that character, putting their hats in the ring to serve in office, because they get it. They understand what it means to sacrifice of yourself to serve others. And I think that's an important factor that we should keep in the forefront of our minds. And anyone that thinks that character doesn't matter is tragically wrong.
And it's not easy to do these days. So, Itamar, I thank you for putting yourself out there to become a public figure. And I found a really interesting quote that would kind of wrap up for today. And it's let's see, Orientalist Sir William Jones is the one who said this. A system of liberty, Jones argued, if forced upon a people invincibly attached to opposite habits, would be a cruel system of tyranny. Americans are not God's angels. We can liberate others from tyranny, but they must fight their own battles to remain free. George Washington and the signers of the Declaration of Independence risked everything for freedom. Many ended up destitute. Our founding fathers sacrificed to obtain their liberty. And I'm afraid that we're going to have to do that again in this day and age, folks. So once again, thanks for being on the American Hour, and we'll catch you next Monday.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Craig.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.